Okay, we're talking some real science tonight with our guest Marcus Krohn, and let's take your phone calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Well, Marcus, let me tell you, you've got a great book here, The Quantum Zoo. I haven't asked you where you can get it.
Well, you should be able to get it from any bookstores, and you should be able to get it from, internet, Amazon.com, something like that.
So you're all over the place?
All over the place, yeah.
Okay, let's go to the calls. Many people calling in, checking in on you. West of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hello, good evening. This is Gwyneth from Eugene, Oregon.
Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. You've been having a fascinating discussion tonight about the origin of the universe. And I have a theory I want to throw in that my husband and I have been reading about recently in a book called Evolution, Dreams, and Value Fulfillment, Volume 1 by Jane Roberts. And I wonder if anybody's familiar with it. It's the theory is this, that if we begin with singularity and then duality forms as a motion, the first motion, and then from that there's more motion, and if you start with consciousness and just assume that singularity creates consciousness and consciousness in dreams as it continues to expand in holographic ways, as you were describing, Marcus, that eventually the energy that's built up and developed in that those conscious dreams eventually build into matter. And so all of the theory that you had, that you described, the multiverse and all of the other things you've discussed tonight, this seems to be pre-matter and energy. So I think it's fascinating.
Well, interesting idea. I do remember, I think it was James Jeans, the British astronomer, who said the universe looks more like a great thought than a great machine. So maybe
might want to check out that book.
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks for the tip.
Appreciate you being on the program. First-time caller line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi, this is Brandon from Indiana, Pennsylvania.
Hello, Brandon. Good morning to you.
I had a question. Marcus was talking about Hubble discovering that the galaxies are moving away from us. But motion, you have to have a point of reference, which he was using as Earth. And if everything is moving in the universe and everything is moving away from us, how are we moving in this galaxy?
Well, that's a good question, because it turns out that on average everything is moving away from us, but the Andromeda galaxy, for instance, which is the nearest big galaxy, is actually falling towards us. It will actually collide with us, I think, in a few billion years' time. But the local group of galaxies is what's called gravitationally bound, so they're all kind of bound, glued together by their own gravity. So you do find this. You find that, yes, the universe is expanding, the galaxies are all flying apart, but they have a little bit of random motion as well. Some of them are glued to each other, for instance, in clusters, and then within the clusters, the galaxies are like jittering around a bit. They have a little bit of random motion. But on average, absolutely everything is flying away from everything else.
So are we the center, or using that motion, can we find the center?
No, we can't, because it turns out that every galaxy or every cluster of galaxies is the center. Everything is flying away from everything else. This is very difficult to imagine. But if you were to sit, for instance, we're sitting on the Milky Way and we look at distant galaxies and they're all flying away from us. If we were to sit on those distant galaxies and look back at the Milky Way, we would see it flying away. Wherever we would sit in the universe, we would have a very similar view. This is why I was saying the Big Bang is a misnomer. It kind of implies that the Big Bang happened at one point. But in fact, what happened in the Big Bang is all of space and matter was created and began expanding everywhere simultaneously. And as I was saying before, it's rather like the galaxy is rather like raisins in a cake. You know, if you imagine the cake rising, if you were small enough to sit on a raisin, you would see all the other raisins moving away from you. But if you sat on another raisin, you would see the same thing. And that's what it's like in the universe.
Okay, thank you. You know, it's interesting, the Big Bang named after the English astronomer Fred Hoyle, but he never believed in it, did he?
Well, I knew Fred Hoyle, very nice guy. Absolutely, he, you're completely right. He actually named it on a BBC radio program like this in 1949. Because and he named it on the spur of the moment, because he believed in something else called the steady state theory, which was the idea that the universe has not evolved from a Big Bang, that has always been, you know, has been the same forever, it's existed forever. And he was just like trying to grasp for some phrase to explain the alternative, which was being promoted by the Russian or the American physicist, Russian-American physicist George Gamow. And he just called it Big Bang. And ever since then, there have been many, many people. They've run competitions in science journals like Nature to try and come up with an alternative. But no one can come up with a better alternative. And it just shows you the importance of names. If you get the name right, it crystallizes people's thoughts. For instance, there was virtually no research on black holes until 1965, when John Wheeler at Princeton coined the term black hole. The Russians called them frozen stars. No way, it didn't really paint a picture in anyone's mind, but the minute you got the term black hole, suddenly everyone can see, and we use it in everyday language. We say, oh, you know, we sent a letter and it went down a black hole. It's just the importance of getting the phrase right. And as you say, Fred Hoyle came up with this term on a radio program in 1949.
Have you ever seen the radio telescope at Arecibo in Puerto Rico?
I've never seen it, but I'd love to see it. Have you?
No, I have not. I've interviewed some people who have been there. While they were there, they were telling me some things about it. Huge, incredible piece of equipment.
Isn't it about like 300 yards across, 1,000 feet
yes,
across?
Yes, I mean, it's just mammoth.
It's in a bowl-shaped valley,
yep.
And they've kind of strung the sort of wiring, you know, the bowl, the dish, over the treetops, so it's absolutely fantastic, isn't it? But of course, it is limited in that it's not steerable, so it can only kind of look at a region above it. Unfortunately, we can't build radio telescopes that are much bigger than about 100 meters across that are steerable, because they just get so heavy they collapse under their own weight, as that one at Green Bank in Virginia did a few years ago.
Let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
You guys were talking, made a reference right before the break about you know, there would be either something or nothing. And it just gave me a flashback of when I was a child trying to figure out if, you know, if there was nothing, if there had never been anything, a universe, you know, as far as my little mind could, you know, imagine then, I would just lie awake at night and think of what nothing would look like. And I, you know, couldn't come up with an answer.
It's just You put your finger on what is the problem. I mean, that is absolutely the biggest problem in cosmology. You know, I mean, why is there something rather than nothing? You know, why have the laws of physics produced this universe, and why is it just not empty? But as you say, how can you imagine nothing?
Right.
It's kind of like imagining something going on forever. You know, you start trying to imagine it, and then you kind of like start screaming, don't you? Because how can you just imagine it going on forever? But, you know, we have to take what we're given, you know. I mean, the universe is the way it is.
Right.
And we are, you know, 5 feet, 6 feet high, you know, made of jelly and water, stuck on this chunk of rock in the middle of nowhere. And we have to kind of try and get our minds around it. And, you know,
Certainly.
We have to take what we're given.
Certainly. I was, you know, just a child, and it would drive me nuts. So I just thought I would throw that out there.
Well, I mean, that's very interesting, because I just think it does drive you nuts. I mean, when I was a child, you know, I used to, like, get books from the library on, I was very sad, actually, you know, get books from the library on astronomy, and all the pictures were artist impressions of what it was like on, you know, Jupiter's moons. I mean, now we're lucky enough we can actually see photographs, you know, from space probes, and I used to kind of try and get my head around it as well, and I was always trying to think, well, how big is Jupiter, and, you know, how far away are the nearest stars, and it's just really, really difficult to get your head around. I mean, space is just big, mind-bogglingly big.
Let's go east of the Rockies. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hi. I just wanted to address the idea that really, you know, the universe kind of came out of nowhere, kind of like the Big Bang and theories and so on. And it seems like the idea of a creator is kind of dismissed out of hand by a lot of scientists. And the way I see it is really, it seems like the Big Bang and evolution seem to be like non-scientific concepts, because science is really the study of what is and not so much what was or how it came to be. And so it seems like it's a lot more conjecture, in my opinion.
Well, as I was pointing out before, I think that the basic Big Bang is beyond doubt, because we just see these observations which tell us that there has to have been a Big Bang. You know, I mean, we're absolutely... the universe is absolutely crammed full of this heat radiation, which is the afterglow of the fireball of the Big Bang. Everything's expanding just as you'd expect. Everything's flying apart just as it was a Big Bang. Now, when you go on to speculate what happened in the first split second, yes, you're absolutely right. Then we are beginning to speculate. We're going beyond what we can actually observe. But we certainly know that the universe began in a hot, dense phase. We definitely don't know what the Big Bang was or where it came from. You know, and there are some scientists who are religious, you know. I mean, I mentioned Newton was, and there are scientists today, and they don't see any problem because you know, the science to them is how things work, not why it works, so they don't see any discrepancy there. But, I mean, I think it's not true to say that the Big Bang is not a scientific theory, because it's just based on our observations. And once again, evolution as well, you know, by natural selection, it's just based on our observations, you know. There are other things where we, you know, like, you know, why did something come from nothing, where science is at sea at the moment. And if you want to, you can say, well, you know, God put it in motion. But certainly the Big Bang is a scientific theory.
Okay, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Hubble, what do you think? How important has it been for astronomy, for the study of the universe?
It's been fantastically important, really. I mean, of course, remember that disaster when it was launched with a squint, and it cost $800 million to fix it. That was a bit of a disaster, wasn't it? But after that, it's been fantastic. I mean, it's produced fantastically clear pictures of the universe. But it's done more important things, like one of the problems we have is actually measuring the size of the universe. How the hell do you do that? We can't get a ruler which we can, you know, stretch out to the nearest galaxies and measure how far away they are. But what we do is look at these things called Cepheid variables, and these are stars which vary their brightness, you know, maybe every month. And it turns out that the time period of their variation is related to their brightness. So if we actually see one with a particular that varies on a certain time period, we know how bright it is, or how bright it should be intrinsically. Then if we see, you know, that it's much, much fainter than we predict, we can kind of estimate how far away the galaxy is. And that's really been very helpful. Hubble has been able to spot these Cepheid variables in a lot of nearby galaxies and give us a handle on how big the universe is. So, I mean, you know, it's just been absolutely fantastic, really. I mean, the interesting thing is that, I mean, you know, when you use a telescope from the surface of the Earth, it's like lying at the bottom of a swimming pool, you know, trying to look at light on the ceiling of a swimming pool. You know, the ripples in the water, they kind of blur everything, and that's the cause of twinkling. You know, stars twinkle because the atmosphere is just like swirling about. So Hubble got above that, but interestingly, astronomers are developing this technique called adaptive optics now, where they actually flex the mirror of their telescope, you know, hundreds of times a minute, and change its shape to compensate for all the swirling of the atmosphere. So effectively, you get to observe the universe, you know, fantastically clearly, as if you're in space, but you're on the surface of the Earth. And this technology is complicated, but of course, in the end, it's much simpler than putting something in orbit. You know, when something was wrong on the space telescope, it cost like $800 million to fix. When something's wrong on a telescope on the Earth, you know, you can go in there with a screwdriver and fix it. You know, it's a lot cheaper.
Okay, let's go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast. You're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah, go ahead, please.
Yes, I had this little silly idea I wanted to run by this guest.
All right.
Back when I was like 8 years old, I had I was reading this shuttle magazine book about the shuttle and going in space, and I had this little premonition. I thought that you can go to speed of light and speed of sound. It's just weird. I was 8, but later on in life, I was thinking about that. And then I saw the rainbow. And I looked at it and how he said about that there's stuff that God put out in space and stuff that we find that will give us clues to the keys of the universe. And when I thought about the light, I thought about navigation and how fast when you're normal you travel the speed of light. But if you're off by a second, you're off by 300,000 kilometers. So I thought as light as the navigation system, and but it says light travels at the same speed, but it has different frequencies. So I was thinking that there would be distance.
I have no idea what you're saying. Not to be rude, but how about a question?
I'm okay, bye.
But you know, it's interesting what you say about light, because, if it wasn't for light, we wouldn't actually have any knowledge at all of the universe. We cannot go out there, and we cannot get a bit of a star. We cannot get a bit of the, we've got a bit of the moon, but we can't get a bit of the planets or anything like that. And we get all of our information just from light. So let's thank goodness for light. That's my only answer to that question.
Let's go west of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast with us. Hello. Going once. Going twice. Going three times. Next wild card line. Welcome to the program. Hi there.
You talking to me?
Yes, sir. I guess so.
This is Bill.
Okay, Bill.
Okay. This is Grizzly Bill. I'm, you can call me Grizzly Bill. I'm just south of the Alaska Panhandle. I'm a first-time caller. But I've listened to your show for years and years and years, you know, Art Bell and the whole bit.
Yeah, thank you.
You guys have done a fantastic job of letting everybody's opinion come through. Whether they're right or wrong isn't the point. Okay? Aside from that, the question I have for your guest is, I could talk to him for hours. He's very knowledgeable. I really enjoy what he's got to say. But I've got a question for him. It has been proved that the observer affects the experiment. Okay? That's pretty much been proved. And Einstein was a very brilliant man, and he's purported as a super genius. I don't know that he would call him that. Really fall in that category. All scientists start out with observable facts from their own and other people's observations, which Einstein did. He took a lot of observations from a lot of different people regarding the bending of light by magnetic forces and so on. And he put it together in a formula and figured out a theory and came up with something that seemed to match what he was observed.
All right, hold on. I want to take your rest of your call when we come right back from the break. I don't want to shorten you. We'll be back. On our next Coast to Coast program, it's those Friday and the Saturday night open lines. I'll be here, and I hope you are too. Well, we'll be back. We'll finish up with final phone calls with our guest, Marcus Crown, on Coast to Coast AM. Let's go back to Bill if we can. Marcus, go ahead, Bill. Let you finish up.
Well, yeah, the interesting little thing, George, I think you probably should get the technicians to check out your computer because it timed out on me. And I had quite a time getting back online because I was holding the line and it cut me off.
Oh, anyway, it's got an automatic cutoff after a while.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and so I don't know how long I'll get to communicate with you. It might time out again. Anyway. One other little point. I am listening to you via CFUN, Victoria, 1410 CFUN.
Very good.
Via Skip. I'm a long-time a radio operator and amateur operator.
Okay, we'll get to your question, Bill, so the time doesn't get you.
I'll get right to it. Okay, for your guest, first of all, the Einstein question, which you probably heard, the scientific approach to things is blurred by our humanity. So consequently, you find things from observations from other scientists, and then you try and figure out a theory that will match it, and then you go back to the same sources that you got the information from to prove your theory. So Einstein's theory of relativity and you know, everything that falls from it is based on that perception. Would you disagree?
No, that sounds correct to me.
Okay. So because we know that it's been proven. Now, I got this from listening to George Norrie. He had somebody on there that said, yes, they have proved that the observation of a scientific experiment offered a change in the experiment if it wasn't observed. Okay? Do you concur with that?
Well, I mean, it's obvious. For instance, if you're examining, you know, human behavior, and you were standing there with a notepad next to somebody, they would behave differently than if they didn't know you were there.
But no, this wasn't human behavior.
No, the interesting thing about physics and the quantum world is that yes, the experiment does affect what you see. In the human world, you can always compensate for it. For instance, you can, as I just said, you can hide yourself so the person doesn't know they're being observed, so they behave naturally. But in the microscopic world, there is no way to compensate, and this leads to something called the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So there's a kind of uncertainty about the microscopic atoms. You can't know exactly. They're a bit fuzzy. You can't know exactly what they're up to.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, you're right on the. That's where that theory came forward, because there was disparities in the work that they couldn't account for. That's where the uncertainty principle came in. You know, they call it uncertainty because they weren't really sure what was going on.
But it's intrinsic. The interesting thing is it's intrinsic uncertainty.
Yeah.
That nature will never, ever allow us to pin down, for instance, certain features of the microscopic world of atoms. It's just the universe is built in such a way that we cannot know all the things that we would like to know. That's very unusual because and very fundamental and very, very strange.
Yeah. And it's okay. Now, having said that, the very observation of what is happening as you go down, the further down the line you go, like the finer particle theory you become involved in, then the least amount of interference from observation becomes very intrusive. Right?
Absolutely right.
Okay. So the speed of light is not a constant if you are interfering with it.
Unfortunately, it is. I just told you that the universe is built in such a way that when you try and look at the fine detail, nature doesn't allow you to know everything you'd like to know. But also, the universe is built in such a way that the speed of light is a constant for everyone, and it's unreachable. We don't know why that's the case, but that's the way the universe is built. Oddly enough, Einstein came to this conclusion really when he was about 16. He was just such a brilliant, clear thinker. He thought to himself, could I ever catch up a light beam? Would I ever be able to? He had these thought experiments. They were very important to Einstein. He didn't actually do actual experiments, but he did thought experiments. Could you catch up a light beam? And it turns out that the great physicists of the 19th century, between Newton in the 17th century and Einstein in the 20th century, was James Clerk Maxwell. He's not known very, very much. He ought to be, because he actually explained all electrical and magnetic phenomena, and he summarized them in a bunch of equations you could put on the back of a stamp called Maxwell's equations. And the interesting thing is that Einstein, when he imagined a light wave, catching it up, well, if you catch a car up, then you're driving next to the car, moving at the same speed. It's not moving relative to you. So if you catch a light wave up, it should be like a frozen wave. It shouldn't be moving at all. But in Maxwell's theory, there is no such thing. So Einstein realized that you could never catch up a light beam, because if you did, you would see something that is impossible. And therefore, the speed of light is the cosmic speed limit. And not only is it unreachable by any physical massive object, only light can travel at the speed of light, But it's the same. Everyone measures it the same. It's constant for everyone. And ultimately, we don't really know why the universe is built in that way, but it is.
Marcus, did you see the incredible story this week? Astronomers announcing that they discovered a possible link between a symbol on an ancient rock carving near Phoenix and a supernova that occurred 1,000 years ago. Did you spot that?
I did. I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Incredible.
Because the supernova you're talking about is considered to be the brightest one to have happened in recorded history. So it's been quite of a mystery why it was not noticed by people in the Americas. And to find that is very interesting because it's kind of, they did notice it.
Yeah, apparently these Native Americans who lived near Phoenix, what is now modern-day Phoenix, from about 580 to 1100, they spotted this and they recorded it as a picture on a huge rock, and that's just amazing. Now, if you were viewing a supernova at the time, why, 900 years later, couldn't we still see it? Does it just fade out? What happens to it?
Yeah, it fades out. I mean, obviously, the explosion is dramatic, and it's a fireball, and that particular supernova you're talking about, it would have been probably as bright as maybe a quarter of a full moon. Now, you can imagine a star
huge.
That bright.
Yeah.
So, in other words, you could virtually read by it, but it would have faded out probably within a few weeks. Basically, as the debris, expelled from the supernova expands, it just cools down. And things cool down from being white hot to red hot, and then they fade away. But, of course, what actually happens is they just cool and produce light that we can't see. So today, we can observe this object with like a radio telescope, because radio waves are given out by pretty cool things. So we can see this remnant, and we can think, it's so big, and it's expanding at such a rate, it must have gone off 1,000 years ago. So then we think, did anyone see it? So it's fantastic. Another thing that's incredible is how historical records can be so important. It turns out that we can look at clay tablets from Babylon, Baghdad, from 700 BC, and they can say something like, we saw a total eclipse of the sun today at 9 o'clock. Now, when we kind of imagine that the Earth and the Moon and the Sun going backwards in time to that time, we think, they shouldn't have seen it at 9 o'clock. They should have seen it at another time. And because there's that discrepancy, we can tell that the Earth's spin has changed, so the length of the day has changed. So the fact that someone recorded something like a total eclipse, even in 700 BC, can tell us something about how the Earth is spinning.
I want to compliment you, by the way, Marcus, on your presentation tonight, because our listeners, just by the nature of all these messages I get all the time, they just absolutely love what you're saying tonight.
Well, fantastic. I mean, I'm really enjoying being on your program, so thanks for asking me.
Would you like to be invited back?
I'd love to be invited back.
Excellent. Let's go back to some more final callers before we wrap things up for the night. East of the Rockies, you're on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
Hi, George. How are you tonight?
Good. Thank you. Who are you and where are you?
Hi, my name's Chris, and I'm calling from Pennsylvania.
Okay, Chris, take it away.
I've been listening to your very knowledgeable guest, and I have a question. whether he might know if there's any either supporting or evidence to deny the fact. there were some interesting things you had mentioned about multiple universes and sort of like soap bubbles kind of all clustered together and things like that. My question is, it may sound like a simple question, but could the defining factor of the universe be size? What I mean by that is, if you would take, say, a small piece of an automobile, a very small swatch, say an inch-by-inch square of a tire, and you look at it under an electron microscope, you would not be able to tell what it is. And if you look at that one-inch-by-one-inch piece from, say, just look at it like as in holding it in your hand, again, you wouldn't be able to tell what it was. Is it possible that, say, the universe is a machine somewhat like an automobile that you wouldn't be able to see beyond the scope of what we can see, what you were talking about, the horizon of the universe? Could it be it's all a small part of an even bigger machine, something that we cannot understand or beyond scope, like scope being the defining factor of the universe? What is beyond the smallest thing we can understand, and what is beyond the largest thing we can understand? Rather than interdimensional barriers, is it possible that it's just simply size that defines what we can understand and how multiple universes might link up? They just might be larger and larger and larger. It seems like in nature there's a lot of repetition. Spherical things with such as subatomic particles that revolve around the nuclei, moving on to larger things like planets and solar systems, even spiral arm galaxies spin and sort of rotate. I don't know. Maybe this is a silly theory. It's just
no, I don't think it's a silly theory at all. I mean, you know, we used to think that atoms were the smallest things, and then we discovered atoms themselves were built of protons and neutrons and electrons. Now we've discovered that the protons and neutrons are built of quarks. And most people think, well, actually, you know, we've got to the end. But history tells us that everyone who said they've actually got to the end has been wrong. So who knows? Quarks may be built of something else. And as you say, on the large scale, it could be we just get bigger and bigger. You know, I mean, we are limited by the fact that we are only, you know, 2 meters tall. As I say, on this chunk of rock in the middle of the universe, it's a vast universe, and we're limited by what we can see and what we can observe with our telescopes. But, yeah, you know, who knows?
Well, thank you. You've been inspiring, and you've really got my mind going tonight. And thank you for taking my call, George. I appreciate
okay,
it.
Okay, absolutely. Our pleasure. Wildcard Line, your turn. You are on Coast to Coast with us. Hi there.
This is Savant. I'm calling from Germantown, Tennessee, and hey. I appreciate you taking my call.
Sure thing.
And I have a question for Marcus. Have you ever heard of an astrophysicist by the name of Gerald Schroeder?
I haven't, no.
He's a Christian, and he's been on TV and been on many radio programs, and what he did is gauging the age of the universe to be, what is it, 13 billion years?
Yeah.
He took that and reversed it back by computer into six 24-hour days by calculating the stretching of the universe fabric and the expansion. He has taken that 13 billion days and reversed it by computer back into a six 24-hour day period, which would then fit along with what it says in the book of Genesis. And George, it might be, if you can figure out how to contact him, or possibly I can email you, he would make a great guest.
Yeah, send me some info on that if you would, Savant.
Okay, and let me do this. Let me ask you.
Sure.
You mentioned just a minute ago that in traveling through the universe that the speed of light would be the limiter. Doesn't Einstein's theory say E equals mc squared? So mass would turn into energy if you go the speed of light squared, not just the speed of light. Would that be correct?
No, I'm afraid that's incorrect. No, the speed of light is the limit. The interesting thing is, you know, what stops you? You know, if I were to, you know, there's nothing in principle to stop me traveling at 200 miles an hour, 300 miles an hour, 800 miles an hour. You know, I mean, we could travel at 50,000 miles an hour if we had enough power. So what stops you getting to the speed of light? It turns out that, as Einstein discovered, things get more massive as they get near the speed of light. So, you know, you start pushing something faster and faster and faster. The speed of light is very fast, 186,000 miles a second. You know, I click my fingers, and a light beam could go seven times around the Earth. So it's pretty fast. But what we know is when you get close to the speed of light, bodies begin to get more massive, so it becomes harder and harder and harder to push them. And if you were to get to the speed of light, you would need an infinite amount of energy to get there. And, you know, so there's basically, you need more energy than there is in the universe. So you can never get to this speed, except if you're light, which is, can travel at the speed of light. And anything that's massless, if there are other particles in nature that are massless, they can travel at the speed of light. But anything with a mass gets more and more massive as it gets nearer the speed of light. So you get fatter as you get near the speed of light.
That makes sense. Where does the squared part come in, though, where it says equals mc squared?
That's right. Well, that's just telling you how much energy there is in matter. So, you know, that's just telling you that mass is a form of energy. So you can actually you can convert that mass into other forms of energy, like heat energy, for instance, in an atomic bomb explosion. That's really, the C squared is just the conversion factor, telling you how much energy there is in a chunk of mass. It's not telling you anything about how fast you can go. But implicit in that formula is that the speed of light is the cosmic speed limit.
That's interesting. I want to make a quick comment, and then I'll let it go. In looking at the consistency of the universe and the matter and energy that's contained within, I do a lot of research myself and have studied the ancient languages that are contained within the scriptures. And in the book of Colossians in the New Testament, it's speaking of Christ, and it says, "For by him were all things created that are in heaven and that are in earth, visible and invisible, whether they be thrones or dominions or principalities or powers. All things were created by him and for him. And he is before all things, and by him all things consist." And if you look at the original scriptures, that term consist is basically saying that by the Spirit of God, by the Spirit of Christ, It holds everything in the universe together, because the term consist means as a glue, that through that intense energy, that spiritual force holds all matter into order instead of going into chaos. And without that spiritual energy holding it together, everything would go into chaos. It's like, for instance, on the Big Bang concept. You know, basically what science has said in so many ways is that there was a chaos that occurred, and then suddenly after billions of years, order came back in, gravity, centripetal, centrifugal force, etc., all played into it. That's kind of like saying that, for instance, a tornado could go through a salvage yard and take all the metal and construct a 727.
That isn't the way it happened at all, because the laws of physics have actually, we can actually run forward the from the Big Bang to today using the laws of physics, and the gravity and the other forces of nature generate what we see around us. They have not created a random universe like that, and your analog of a tornado going through a scrapyard is not correct.
Marcus, we're almost out of time. One, thank you. Your website is, you want to spell it for us?
It's www.marcuschown, that's marcuschown.com, C-O-M.
All right, there you are in the United Kingdom, so enjoy the rest of your day, Marcus.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed being on your program.
You'll get some great response. Thanks.
I hope so. Okay. Okay, cheers.
Appreciate you being part of the program. Fascinating theory. It really is. Okay, on our next Coast to Coast program, don't forget, it's our Friday night into Saturday morning open lines with a special hotline, so who knows what's going to happen on that day. Plus, we'll always be checking some of the late-breaking news of the day. For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean LaDesure, Ross Mitchell, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.